Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, a director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that influenced their own work in a strange way. And today, I'm real excited to have actor, writer, director Mitzi Perone with me. Hi.
Hi, April.
For those of you who are not as familiar with Mitzi's work, please let me give you an introduction. Mitzi was born and raised in Turin, Italy, where she received an intensive classical humanistic education, focusing on philosophy, art history, Greek tragedy, opera, and literature. You know, the usuals.
Yeah.
After high school, Mitzi left Italy to study theater in New York City at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. She acted in a few short films, Not Now, Wonderland, and Dreamland, and took up modeling and painting. But her artistic drive pushed her in the direction of writing her own screenplays. She ended up writing and directing a short film called Chaosmos. Is that how I'm supposed to say it?
Yes.
And directing another short called Vesperlings while she geared up for a feature. The screenplay for Braid rapidly became her main focus. And in 2016, Mitzi partnered up with entrepreneur Joseph Lubin. Is that correct? Lubin?
Yes, very correct.
To create a new business model to finance her film, which became the first one ever to be fully financed through a cryptocurrency equity crowd sale.
Woo!
God damn. Wow. The sale raised $1.7 million in 2 weeks. The film premiered at Tribeca in 2018 and won Best Picture at the Lausanne Underground Film Festival. Braid, which tells the story of two women who decide to rob their wealthy psychotic friend but must participate in the friend's perverse game of make-believe, received worldwide distribution via Blue Fox Entertainment. Mitzi then signed with ICM, and her next directorial effort is a sci-fi thriller set in a tech apocalypse starring Bella Thorne.
Yeah.
So you've had a kind of nutty couple of last years, it seems like.
Definitely.
Well, I mean, I'm excited to see what's happening next. But Braid is certainly a mind bender, we'll say.
Yes.
We'll get into a lot of that. But it also kind of influences your choice of what you picked today to talk about. You chose Donnie Darko.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that one of your fave genre
the
films?
The craziest movie of all time.
Tell
possibly.
Me about it.
For many reasons. First of all, because of how polarizing it is.
Mm-hmm.
I love anything that starts up a controversy because I think that art should ask questions more than offering simple answers.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that divides an audience has caused some kind of concussion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important. I think it's more important to create something that, even if it's not perfectly resolved,
mm-hmm.
is opening a sort of like visual meditation,
because
mm-hmm. you can't fully 100%, and I've watched Donnie Darko like 7 times, I think, throughout my lifetime.
Yeah.
I have never like fully gathered every single piece of information in it, but it gives me every single time, it gives me new ideas
mm-hmm.
to think about.
For those of you who haven't seen Donnie Darko, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. Again, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Donnie Darko first, then this is your shot. And now that you're back, let's introduce Donnie Darko. Written and directed by Richard Kelly for release in 2001, Donnie Darko stars Jake Gyllenhaal as an 80s teen who one night wanders outside and begins talking with a giant rabbit monster named Frank, who tells Donnie that the world will end in exactly 28 days, 6 hours, 42 minutes.
42 seconds.
12
42
seconds.
Minutes and 12 seconds.
I know. Donnie then wakes up on a golf course, wanders home, where he finds a jet engine of mysterious origins has crashed into his bedroom. He obviously survived, however, because he was gone. Donnie keeps talking to Frank, so his parents send him to a therapist.
I met a new friend.
Real or imaginary?
Imaginary.
Would you like to talk about this friend?
Frank.
Frank. What did Frank say?
He said to follow him.
Follow him? Where?
Into the future.
Frank talks about time travel, so Donnie asks his science teacher, Mr. Monatoff, if time travel is possible. And Monatoff, played by Noah Wiley, gives him a book called The Philosophy of Time Travel.
Listen, don't tell anybody that I gave you this. The woman who wrote this used to teach here. She was a nun many years before that, but then overnight she became this entirely different person. She up and left the church. She wrote this book. She started teaching science right here at Middlesex.
The philosophy of time travel. Roberta.
Roberta Sparrow?
A former teacher who's now a recluse on the outside of town. Donnie starts dating a girl named Gretchen, played by Jenna Malone.
Mm-hmm.
But Frank is taking him down a dark road, influencing his actions. He breaks a water main at school, for instance, and this anonymous bad behavior causes one of the teachers to call in motivational speaker Jim Cunningham, played by the wonderful Patrick Swayze.
Good morning, you mongrels.
Good morning.
Now, is that all the gusto you can muster? I said, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, that's a tiny, tiny bit better. But I can still sense some students out there who are actually afraid to say, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, that's what I like to hear. Because entirely too many young men and women today are completely paralyzed by their fears.
Whom Frank and Donnie do not like. Frank convinces Donnie to burn down Jim's house.
Burn it to the ground.
And the firefighters, in response to that, do find a cache of child pornography, so Jim gets arrested. It's all very serendipitous.
Mm-hmm.
Donnie's mom, dad, and little sister then all have to go out of town because of random things set off by Donnie's actions. Donnie and his older sister then, Elizabeth, played by Maggie Gyllenhaal, decide to throw a Halloween party to celebrate Elizabeth's acceptance into Harvard. Gretchen shows up to the party very worried and sad, but she and Donnie have sex for the first time anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Then the two and some of their other friends head off to the Sparrow house because Donnie remembers the world is about to end. So he knows that something is happening and it has to be at this house.
And he's led there by the word cellar door.
This famous linguist once said that of all the phrases in the English language, of all the endless combinations of words in all of history, that cellar door is the most beautiful.
And they go to the house.
And surprise, surprise, the villains are there waiting for them.
Yes. So the mm-hmm. classmates there, they're trying to rob this house. And a car swerves while they're fighting. And it hits Gretchen.
Mm-hmm.
And it kills Gretchen.
Her.
And Elizabeth's boyfriend, Frank, exits the car in a giant rabbit costume, and mm-hmm. you're like, oh, shit. Then Donnie shoots Frank in the eye and then carries Gretchen's body to watch the plane his mom and sister are on get its engine torn off. So you're in like another kind of like freak time warp. Donnie then wakes up in his bed, looks at the calendar. It is October 2nd, and a jet engine crashes and kills him. Everyone mourns Donnie, and Gretchen, who didn't know Donnie in this life, in this timeline, just looks at his house and gets an eerie sense of something.
Goosebumps.
Okay. I mean,
so much to talk about.
We'll talk about, like, let me start maybe with a quote from Kelly, because he said, everyone's always like, what's it about? What's it about? Ever since this movie has been out, that's the main question that he gets asked. He said, quote, there really isn't a concrete answer of what this film's about. It's about what each viewer wants it to be about.
Mm-hmm.
I like to let people come up with their own answers. I see it as more of a science fiction story. I see it as a superhero story in a lot of ways, too. Other people see it as a movie about mental illness, or they see it as a film about a dream. They're all equally valid theories, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, yes. Also, that's funny enough. It's obviously one of the things that I get asked the most about my movie Braid. Not
mm-hmm.
so much what is it about, but it's been since it came out. It's been a constant of DMs and emails and
mm-hmm.
like text messages of, here's my theory and tell me how off I am.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're never wrong. Of course, like whenever someone tells me exactly what I intended to write, that's, I guess, when it makes me the happiest. But the coolest thing about, I think, both movies is this idea of, like, Chinese box of meanings.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that a movie can make you think, it's not necessarily, of course, motion pictures. Movies are supposed to make us feel things.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the brain? What about thinking about stuff?
Yeah.
What about coming up with reasons why we feel certain things and we have certain dreams? And somehow how, like, everything could be looked at in a way that it's always like been laid out for us in a certain way. Like
mm-hmm.
you said, everything is a bit too serendipitous.
Like we have to be conspiracy theorists in a sense to watch movies and to kind of draw our own meanings from it. You
mm-hmm.
know, we all have our little kind of map of like
why
the yarn going from here
that
to
moment.
That picture.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and every single time you make a decision, there's like this like fork pathway. And Donnie ended up in a in a parallel universe, but in a way, we always end up in parallel universes. Like, I could have not made it today mm-hmm. to this podcast. And
oh no!
What would you have done?
I don't know. Maybe something like really weird would have happened in my life.
I don't know.
But the idea of actually sitting down to write these kinds of stories, mm-hmm. though, I think that does kind of freak some writers out. I think you know, because it is. It's kind of a strange thing to kind of put your dream state on a page or mm-hmm. what you decide that is, you know, because so much about movies is having these kind of airtight containers, you know, like this is what it is. And right. This is what sells.
Formulas and prototypes of what should work.
Yeah. Save the fucking cat. You mm-hmm. know, that shit.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how do you sit down to write something like that? And in terms of, you know, like Braid, if we're talking about that movie, I mean, there are times when, you know, make believe and reality are
blend.
They blend, and mm-hmm. you're not quite sure exactly which mm-hmm. part is which.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something I think can be frustrating to executives, whereas audiences are very often pleased to find something that doesn't have a complete, this is exactly the way you're supposed to feel or see.
Right.
This.
I mean, I think that we definitely have like certain narrative structures that we inevitably stick to. If you think about it, Donnie Darko is also like a tragic hero journey.
Yeah.
Because he starts off from like his point A from normal life, goes into some sort of an underworld, like Alice in Wonderland falls into a hole.
Sure.
Or
and you have the rabbit
Odyssey.
Symbiology or the symbology
Very good.
Too, you know? So
but in the end, both movies do have this like breath, this like whisper of what if none of this is real?
Yeah.
Like, of what we live in, which is in the end the simulation hypothesis, the theory behind the idea of life and reality could just be a simulation, which mm-hmm. is something that I think we all think about at some point in our lives. And for me, Braid came from a moment in my life in which I had moved from Italy to New York City to pursue acting. And I had gotten this part. I was really excited about it. I worked on it for like 2 years. I was 22. And then the director hit on me and then fired me. And at the same time...
Yeah, that'll happen. Yep.
Yeah. At the same time, my modeling agency had lost my visa. So I was 22 and I was an immigrant and I was unemployed and I couldn't go back home to Italy because I wouldn't have come back in.
Mm-hmm.
But I also had nothing else to do in the United States. And I had left on such a like a I'm going to go follow my dreams and my dreams will follow me hyper idealistic view of my life. And in that moment, I just had this like breakdown and meltdown that turned into this like philosophical liberation of none of this is real in a way that I had conjured up all of this for me to get to the point at which I would no longer act, but write Braid. So everything's happening for a reason. Like I was the abusive director. I was my own circumstances.
Yeah.
So in that moment, and the part of the reason why we used mirrors a lot in Braid, it's not so much, it's also about the idea of like split personalities because the girls embody these like alter egos while they're playing of things that they need out of their real life that they didn't get.
Mm-hmm.
But within the make-believe, everything is possible. So Petula can be a doctor and Tilda can be this like, I don't know, bratty 12-year-old girl. And Daphne, who's barren in real life, she plays the mother. So they're all like fulfilling their like unfulfilled needs within the world of make-believe.
I think that if we're looking at the impetus for where your Braid came from and where Donnie Darko came from, mm-hmm. I don't think that they're dissimilar.
No.
Because Kelly was, he said, quote, I was 23, just graduating from film school and in a panic trying to write a screenplay to get my career started. I remembered a news story I'd read as a kid about a huge chunk of ice that fell from the wing of a jet and hit a boy's bedroom, but he wasn't there and escaped being killed. That gave me the seed of the idea. But the thing is that he was graduating from school. I think he went to USC. And he was like, oh, if I don't write this right now, my career will never go mm-hmm. anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just like taking that kind of kernel of an idea and said, I need to make whatever I can. And at the same time, he was also trying to separate himself from a pack because I think when he had grown up, he said, quote, I was brought up in a very fraternal order of Southern California college students. I see myself as an emo being trapped in a frat house and socialized by a fraternity system that everyone had to go through in college. Now, with social media, there are so many other ways to meet people. So I was kind of trapped in the system where I was trying to break out. And that's why I wrote the script, because I really wanted to be realized as an artist.
There is like a good way of utilizing your anxiety, I think.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get a little bit more into the process of casting these movies and also being kind of possessive over your script and trying to make it your vision all the way throughout. Okay, we'll be right back.
Hello, Internet. I'm your husband host, Travis McElroy.
And I'm your wife host, Teresa McElroy.
And together we present Schmanners.
It's extraordinary etiquette.
For ordinary occasions.
We explain the historical significance of everyday etiquette topics, then answer your questions relating to modern life.
So join us weekly on MaximumFun.org or wherever podcasts are found.
No RSVP required.
Check out Schmanners.
Manners, Schmanners. Get it?
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Mitzi Perrone, and we're talking about Donnie Darko. Okay, so the thing is that a lot of people thought that Kelly should have had someone else direct this movie. It was his first movie, in the same way that Braid was your first feature. And, you know, it's a really complex script, and he was, you know, only 24, 23, and they really didn't trust him. You know, they wanted other people to direct the script.
I didn't know that.
But he said that letting someone else direct was never an option for him. And he said, quote, I knew it would never see the light of day or be drastically rewritten. Once Drew Barrymore signed on, we got the finance that we needed, however. That was $4.5 million. Having Drew also helped us get other actors who might have been reluctant to work with a first-time director. We originally had Jason Schwartzman as Donnie, but he had other commitments. Jake Gyllenhaal had just starred in October Sky and ended up carrying the whole movie. So,
wow. I mean, I didn't know that it was even I can't imagine something that comes, that's so personal, clearly, to the writer.
Yeah.
It's hard to let someone else do it for you. And also, if a studio picks up a movie, more often than not, there's a chance, a big chance, that it's going to just like sit in development hell for God knows how long.
Yeah. Until you get the rights back, maybe.
Exactly. And, considering also the anxiety, that like healthy anxiety that the movie came from, specifically about that time of his life, early 20s are always a little dark, a little too like inquisitive of your own psyche and your own
yeah.
world.
I mean, if they're not, you're not doing it right.
Right, exactly. I think what's so great is that he exposed his own fears of like, what if none of this is real? And what if like time travel is real and this we're living in some kind of a simulation dream, the shadow of a dream, this everything that we call life. So, and in the same way, I made Braid as a form of like artistic manifesto, this like visual poem to explain that reality is an extension of our thoughts. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, everything in society is invented. Our jobs, our names, politics, society in general, even time and geographical borders. So what separates us from kids playing make-believe, really? Nothing. We just like have the like we have constructed this like global sandbox and we validate ourselves into what we think we are by repeating our actions over and over and telling ourselves we are April Wolf, we are Mitzi Perrone, we're doing this, but also what are we doing?
I mean, I'm like about 50% of the time I'm April Wolf, we'll say. The other parts.
You tell yourself you are.
I know, exactly.
Every morning, I am April Wolf.
I'm curious. So Drew Barrymore was essentially the savior, I think, for Kelly's work. She produced it and also agreed to play one of the teachers.
I mean, that's bonkers that he got the actors that he got. Absolutely.
I mean,
insane.
Pulling some big punches in there.
For also supporting parts.
I know.
Yeah.
Did you cast your actors before you started fundraising?
It happened at the same time.
Really?
Yeah. Imogen Waterhouse was the first one that attached.
Mm-hmm.
And then Maddie came along, and then Sarah Hay. But we started the sale on June 7th. We kind of had to do that thing of, we have the money, but not yet. So to get the actors, and then the actors are on board. I'm like, no, now we really have to make this happen.
There is no...
It was terrifying, obviously. Oh, I'm not proud of it. I don't want to do it again. But you kind of have to do that. At least when you're starting out and you're taking a massive risk. Obviously, I'm not encouraging anybody to lie, but it is true. You will come to that moment in which, especially if you have a script that's like offbeat and you're not an established director, you don't have a studio backing you up. You can go to Indiegogo and Kickstarter and beg your friends and family for money. That's not going to like get you the money to make a movie. Yeah. Also, it's a flawed system. It's like charity. You're not actually incentivizing your contributors to give you money because they're not going to get anything back, really.
Yeah, so your donations, there aren't donations necessarily because they're more investment. You can see a kind of a reward or something from it.
Yeah, no, our investors are going to be the first ones to get paid back with an additional 15%.
Yeah, okay.
So it is like a true investment. And the fact that I tapped into a business audience that's not filmmakers but entrepreneurs, the idea of applying their technology to something that was like hip and cool, directed by a woman that had like all these like very strong philosophical themes, but also that was always told in this like decadent, like over the top way, this was going to be something special, and I think everybody knew that.
I want to talk about distribution and the idea that no one wanted to distribute this fucking movie, like, at all.
Yeah, I mean, people would be scared of something like this.
I mean, so this premiered...
Especially distributors.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. This premiered at Sundance, right? And every major distributor passed on it at Sundance, and that was in 2001. And Kelly said, quote, "It was viewed as a problem film that no one knew how to market. Mm-hmm. It looked like it might go to straight to video, but then New Market picked it up. They'd done Memento, another experimental film seen as a hard sell. Its director, Christopher Nolan, convinced New Market to give Donnie Darko a chance." Right. Then it got released on Hollywood Weekend after 9/11. And
that wasn't a smart idea.
Yep. And didn't even make $1 million. And no one was in the mood to see any kind of movie, especially one with a heavy emotional core.
Yeah.
So that is like the worst possible scenario for how this movie would get released. There's, you know, a lot of the imagery, especially, you know, in the marketing, you have the imagery of a plane falling from the sky, right? And that's just not what anyone after 9/11 wanted to see.
No,
one fucking month right after it.
Yeah. And besides that, I think unfortunately we have come to, we're getting out of it slowly, but there's definitely the vast majority of moviegoers that just want to feel okay. They want to watch something that's not going to like throw them off too much. That's not going to make them think too much. Reason why we have like so many sequels and prequels of stuff. It's like pop music, and it's anything that makes you feel okay and familiar and safe. That's usually what distributors want, because they know how it's going to play. They know what audience to market it to. They have comparables that basically are the same exact movie over and over. And anything like Donnie Darko or anything like Braid definitely needs to find a smaller, I would recommend anybody who's going through the same process to go to the smaller distribution companies.
Yeah.
The ones that will take a bet on you.
Yeah. That's, I mean, I understand why people, because sometimes I want to feel fucking good at a movie theater.
Oh, no, it's
great. But you have to have a kind of mix of that. I do think it's interesting, though, that, you know, his movie set in 1988. Mm-hmm. And in 1988, we had a lot of the same kind of similar productions of movies where things were really harsh in the world in the 80s. And so you had a lot of movies that were kind of fluff. And media that was kind of fluffed because it was something where everyone was so fucking just like Cold War'd out and they just couldn't think of anything else. So the production of this fluff just kind of increased exponentially. The 90s heralded something else in. But I mean, it's a weird kind of parallel that
he decided to set it in that time in which everything else was like very feel good.
Yeah.
And that's like Donnie Darko.
Yeah. I wanted to get into the idea of youth and risk, because Kelly said that he really couldn't have made this film if he weren't young. And he said, quote, "I think the film could have only been made by someone that young. We took a lot of risks in making it. And those kinds of risks are rarely taken by someone with a more seasoned track record of success and failure. The older you get, the more risk adverse you become because you have family or publications or a mortgage, those kinds of things that come with adulthood. So when you're 25 years old, you don't necessarily have any of those things and you take crazier risks. Sometimes they can ruin your life. Sometimes they can give you a career."
Absolutely. I mean, I think especially when you're young, you should be taking risks because it's statistically the best time for you to do crazy things.
Yeah, your bones are more malleable. Like you can you can fall, you can get back up, everything heals.
But also nobody's I had this moment I was like before pre-production because once I got on set I was like, we got this.
Yeah.
Before, obviously, it was like, I don't know what I'm doing. Why does anybody trust me? And then I kept like looking at myself in the mirror being like, this is a farce, Mitzi. Like, and I'm like, all right,
oh,
it's
shit,
a farce.
That's dark.
But that also liberated me in a way. I was like, I'm just going to do it and like see what happens. And I think that the greatest thing about, taking risks while you're young is that also nobody can really blame you.
Mm-hmm.
On your first film, nobody's going to be like, oh, well, this is, it's your first film. You can fuck up in a way.
Yeah.
But fuck up like gloriously.
Yeah. Show some promise.
Don't do something safe, especially now. Then like once you're like, I guess, older and you have like more responsibilities and you can't really afford to fail anymore, do the sequel of the prequel of whatever it is that's in right now. But definitely first film should be the wildest and boldest. I'm already like feeling, I'm 28 now, I'm getting into my next one, and I'm like, I miss the like wild bravado of Braid a little bit.
Are you
bit.
Planning things a lot now? Are you like over planning? Are you like thinking about
just,
the end result now?
I'm thinking, I would say that when I was making Braid, whenever I had people telling me things like, are you sure people are going to get this? I was like, the hell with people. I'm not going to water down my vision because it like, I should, but it's true. Artists should not water down their vision for fear of not being understood. Otherwise, art is dead. Don't make your decisions based on what if people don't get it. And it's a hard, it's like so easy to preach that, but it's so hard once you have $2 million.
You're like, oh
and
my God.
Like judging you or like coming up with reviews and telling you, I didn't like the movie. Because I didn't understand it. Oh, well.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the filming process, finding locations, dealing with, you know, what might be a political film and other film, inspirations. Other film inspirations. We'll be right back.
Hey everybody, this is J. Keith Van Stratton, host of Go Fact Yourself, a live game show here on the Maximum Fun Network. On Go Fact Yourself, we take the smartest people we know and make them look dumb.
Oh, by the way, how much do you know about chicken husbandry?
You gotta give them that grain.
All right.
You gotta give them that grain.
And then smart again.
What future Hall of Fame pitcher for the Cleveland Indians became the first active player to enlist?
Bob Feller.
Okay.
We've got me, co-host Helen Hong, plus celebrity guests and actual surprise experts.
All right, we have an expert on hand who can tell us for sure.
Is it Alan Havey?
Helen, who do we have tonight?
Alan Havey!
Alan Havey!
In the coming weeks, you can hear guests like Maria Bamford, Tom Bergeron, Paul F. Tompkins, Janet Varney, and Grant Imahara. Check us out on the first and third Friday of every month here on the Maximum Fun Network.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Mitzi Perron, and we are talking about Donnie Darko. Okay, so you mentioned earlier that you were really psyched to be working with your DP, your director of photography, and the director of photography on this is actually Stephen Poster, and really, really fantastic cinematographer. And he, when Kelly was looking through like a list of, you know, like resumes and of DPs, he saw Stephen Poster and was just like, oh shit, because he'd been working in the industry and he was just like, I would get a chance to work with someone who did Ridley Scott's Someone to Watch Over Me. I'm going to fucking take it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of watched over the production and really kind of became this
like father figure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, gave him the confidence, I think, to do the shots that he wanted to do, like the complicated one where the executive producers are like, why are you doing this?
Yeah, why is it upside down?
Well, because it looks fucking cool, first off. But I think that that kind of partnership, especially when you're young,
sacred,
is just so important. And it's something where you don't want someone who's going to overtake your vision, but who can, you know, guide you in
absolutely
the direction that you want to be.
Yeah, you definitely want to find someone who just gets you, who's not going to, again, overpower you just because you're young and don't have the same amount of experience. You want someone who eventually, by the end of production, my DP and I weren't even talking anymore. We're just like looking at each other. We knew if we needed to go again or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember meeting Todd Benhazel at a coffee shop at 5 p.m. on a Tuesday, chugging coffee. And I'm like, okay, no, this is the guy. It's got to be. And he goes, I'm going to shoot your movie like Caravaggio and LSD. That was it for me. I was like, I'm hiring him. I don't even need to know if he knows, because he clearly does know. He gets it. And it's, I think it's important that you develop a language that you don't have to explain, oh, well, Caravaggio is this Renaissance painter. You know,
yeah,
they have to know these things.
That's so nice that he named an Italian Renaissance painter.
Flattering.
I wanted to get into some of the mechanics of this that I thought were pretty interesting. For instance, this film shot for 28 days, exactly. So what Kelly says, the length of the tangent universe of the movie. So they had a nice day for each day of the movie. Universe. I thought that was really lovely.
Yeah, it's
kind of comes full circle. There's also the fact that there's these small details, like you're saying with your movie, where you can kind of piece together everything that's happening in the film from, you know, the clues that you set in here. There's one clue that a lot of people latched onto, and that was the movies that are playing in the theater. So like what's on the marquee, because The Last Temptation of Christ is on there, as is Evil Dead. And, quote, this is what Kelly was saying about Last Temptation. Last Temptation came out in 1988, but was banned in a lot of cities and theaters. And there are characters in the story that die and are resurrected. One may argue that Donnie is a Christ-like figure in the sense of him being crucified by the jet engine at the end of the film, or in some way sacrificing himself. Those themes play into each other. It was an irresistible marquee to put up.
Absolutely. No, so doesn't the film burn at the end of The Last Temptation of Christ, I think. Also just like this idea of crossing in between realities, and the fact that he is in a movie theater, Donnie, when he speaks with Frank.
Yeah.
Again, the idea of the Chinese box of the reality within a reality within a reality.
But it's fun to plant those things.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think it's not even fun. You know, I talk to people where it's just like people really, like executives, everyone else, like they demand those Easter eggs and like, because there is a kind of dream logic that's happening while you're kind of piecing the film together that even if you don't pick up on it completely, you still do kind of remember it and fills in as you watch the movie. What did you, so you said there were drawings on the wall in yours?
Yeah, so at the very beginning of the movie, when the girls get to the house, there's drawings, like children drawings, on the fridge that have basically spelled out the most, I guess, iconic scenes in the movie and the world of make-believe. And that's before they get to the house. So how did they know that was going to happen? And in the end, you see that the game after, even again, resurrection, there's like this idea of ego death. The girls have been spiraling into this world of make-believe so hard that they don't know anymore what's real and what isn't, and even their attempts of getting out are useless, because Petula, who's like the girl that we're following the most throughout the movie, because she starts off like fairly grounded and then loses her mind probably the most out of the three of them, she's trying to leave, and the girls tell her, you're coming back, you're always gonna come back, in this like never-ending loop. So the moment in which they kill themselves, unfortunately, it's as if they only died in their dreams. And so instead of, it's like their like last resort to like get out of this world of madness that they've built for themselves. And unfortunately, and ironically and cynically, when after they die, they return to the house as if nothing ever, as if that death didn't matter because they only died in their dreams. And it's funny, Donnie Darko, in the end, it's like, the dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had, the song in the end.
Mm-hmm.
So what does happen when we die in our dreams? Like, it's, I think it's a super compelling question. Do we go into another world? Like, what happens to our, like, our sleeping selves and all of their adventures?
Mitzi, you're blowing my mind right now. I don't...
So the girl...
Like, what? Oh, my God. What does happen if I die in my fucking dream?
Well, I mean, it's, if you think about, again, if you think about reality as not necessarily, okay, so you can touch things, you can feel things, but your senses deceive you. So that's not going to be a valid argument to describe that, to tell me that this world, this reality right now is real. What separates reality from dreams is the question behind Braid. And the answer, what would happen if the answer was nothing? So that's why the movie has this like blending of reality and fantasy, because I believe they're the same. I believe that if you, whenever I have a bad dream, I wake up, I'm sweating, I feel terrified still. And those memories go in the same area of your brain that holds real memories. Sometimes I can't remember if something actually happened or if I dreamed it or if I thought about it hard enough that it became something in my head. Fortunately, that happens with work too. Sometimes I think I answer emails and I didn't. Because you thought about answering it.
Yes. Producer Casey knows that sometimes I forget to answer texts or emails.
But you did in your head.
Did I answer? I mean, I formulated with a response in my head. I just didn't send anything.
Right. I mean, it happens. So, the girls think they can get out. They can't, actually. They're, like, stuck in this world of make-believe that in the end, it is this, like, big metaphor for all of your anxieties and fears and, like, things you, like, put up on yourself. Like, if, you know... Anxiety, for instance, is a made-up thing, but it builds walls around your mind and your own persona. So that's what the house is. It's like this like toxic place that's safe and it's nice. And it's this like childhood world of make-believe, and the rules are so simple and it's so easy to stay in there. And it's so much harder to get out. So hard to get out of your own paranoia.
So the scariest haunted house is actually inside your own brain. I want to get into another thing about movies that are made for a kind of not like young adult characters or things that represent or portray younger adults and the ways in which movies generally portray them. Donnie Darko does things a little bit differently because Richard Kelly resisted the kind of studio notes type of thing to make things more like sexual, to make this character, you know, maybe more obsessed with sex and things because he's a teenage boy. And that's what teenage boys in movies do. Right.
So
Jake Gyllenhaal said, quote, "It wasn't a conventional adulthood, young adulthood film in the American Pie way. And that was popular. Donnie talks about jerking off, but that's only part of it. His psychological journey is what's important. That's why it's his lasting power. Anything psychological has a slower but ultimately longer burn." And that's something we were talking about earlier. Yeah. But I do think it ties back to the fact that these are people, you know, these are teens, whether it's Maggie Gyllenhaal's character as the older sister or Jake Gyllenhaal's younger brother who's got some mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are more than just hormones.
Absolutely.
And I think adults and studios, they kind of see younger people as just, oh, all hormones.
And yeah. I mean, that's also like what Donnie, I think, says it when they talk about Watership Down. Like, they're just rabbits and they're cute and horny. Why should we care?
Yeah.
I think that's the author saying this is not like this is not just a bunch of like horny young kids.
Yeah.
And yeah, again, the psychological aspect of it, I think that's also like the great equalizer, because I, as a girl, I didn't need a female character to relate to the story.
Yeah.
Or older audience members. Everybody can latch onto Donnie, because Donnie's not going through like 20, whatever, 17, 15, 21 year old problems. He's going through like big, like existential, massive questions.
Yeah, yeah.
Honestly, everything that they did with his character, from like his posture and the way he talks, I think it's so much more appealing than just like seeing the stereotypical. Anything stereotypical in the end doesn't leave a deep impression. It goes away because it gets replaced by the same thing a month later.
Yeah. I noticed in your movie you resisted it seems like some sexual overtones and things that.
Yeah,
when you have a lot of women together in the in these kind of psychological
like
situations,
power plays, but it's not so much about. Yeah, I mean, I really wanted to make sure that the girls didn't depend on, didn't talk about boys.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because the Bechdel test is like, do you have two characters who are women who have names? It's just the bar is so low.
I know.
Who have names that do something else besides talking about men.
Yeah.
And yeah, the girls never talk about boys or men ever at all. They're nobody's sisters or mothers besides the world of make believe, obviously. Yeah. But they don't exist to assist a man in at all ever. And the only man that tries to save them ends up getting killed.
Mm-hmm.
He goes from like being the knight in the shining armor, also with Don Giovanni playing in the back by Mozart. In that moment, Don Giovanni is asking the devil to dinner.
Yeah.
And then he dies. Yeah. So there's also like that idea of sort of like subverting the that women are the what is it, the softer, the weaker, the gentler sex. It's not true.
Yeah, that's get why them on I their wanted, own.
That's why I know, like, you don't want to put three like unhinged women like on some kind of just like personal like journey, because it's gonna end up in like just, you know, intense, sometimes even too intense to handle type of picture. That's why I wanted the murder to be so over the top and so cathartic and like so bloody and so intense. Because they're not just killing Siegel. Again, he's not a person. He represents something.
Yeah.
They're killing pretty much every single man that's ever, you see them on the train with like guys kind of like winking at them or trying to get something out of them. They're seen as sexual objects.
Yeah.
And then they flip the tables on them. In the end, Petula, it looks like she's about to give him a blowjob in the bathroom on the train, and he ends up on one knee licking her foot, in the same way as Tilda gives the middle finger to the guy on the train. There's this idea of like wanting to subvert stereotypes of women as cute and sexy and like harmless. Now we're ferocious and capable of anything.
Yeah. And that's essentially, I mean, like, you're trying to give, Richard Kelly's trying to give a real character to this young boy who's just like, no, there's much more in his brain than just fucking like sex and football and pizza or some shit. And, you know, as much as you can do it with women as well, you know, all these people who are just like, we don't think about what their internal lives are. Mm-mm. We just think about what Hollywood's portrayal of them. And I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking to me today about Donnie Darko. And how can people see Braid?
It's on Amazon Prime right now and Vudu and iTunes, I believe.
Wonderful. So go check it out on Amazon Prime, Vudu, and iTunes, and, you know, maybe all three, whatever. again, thank you so much for coming to chat with me.
Thank you, April. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Now, is that all the gusto you can muster? I said good morning.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.